Boy, it's a lazy Sunday here at the secret underground lair of the Functional Nerds. Actually, I'm not even downstairs. I'm upstairs with all the doors and windows open, enjoying a very lovely, cool day here in Denver, Colorado. And I'm going to have such a lazy day because the Three Horsemen are back and they record a podcast, so I don't have to. I can just kick back, relax, and let you guys listen to this. So, you know, episode 198, SF Signal, Three Horsemen. Take it away, Jeff.
Hi, this is Jeff Patterson, and we are here for another episode of The Three Horsemen, brought to you by the SF Signal podcast. And just like last time, I am joined by two people who know more than I do about most things. Say hello, John Stevens.
Hello, John Stevens.
How is John Stevens today?
I am doing well. I just came back from ReaderCon, and I'm full of stories to tell.
I want to hear all about it. Also with us tonight is Mr. Fred Kish.
Hi, this is Fred Kish, occasional podcast host / guest on SF Signal and many other sites, mostly on Twitter.
Okay, and in the spirit of full disclosure, for anyone who's been following along, when I released my ebook last month, Don't Tweet Where You Eat, available on Kindle, I did misspell Fred's name. So I am now on record as both misspelling and mispronouncing his name, so I've requested that he actually change it.
You and 10 million other people.
If we're going to go phonetically, it should be Kaiche, which was his 90s R&B artist name. So we got a few things we want to talk about. We've been discussing a few things on Twitter in the intervening week since our first episode. First thing I wanted to get to is I want to hear from John all about ReaderCon. He gave us many good tweets while he was there, and that was simply the tip of the iceberg to whet our appetite. So, John, tell us about it.
Yes. So, I was at ReaderCon last weekend, and this was the second time I've done the whole thing. I've actually been to 10 ReaderCons. I went to the first two, then skipped a whole bunch, and I've been to the last eight now. And the last two, I've actually been a participant. And last year, I was only on two panels, and I gave a talk. And this year, I ended up being on five panels and giving a talk. Because of my own excessive enthusiasm. Last year, I went through the process. Participants actually go through a process of saying what they want to be on, what they like, things like that. And I was very enthusiastic to share with the stuff that I liked, and thus I ended up on a lot of panels. So I attended several great panels. I ran a couple of panels. I gave a talk that was fairly well received. And ReaderCon is still my favorite con, mostly because it does focus on literature. For those who don't know much about ReaderCon, it's probably more maybe a medium size. I don't know. It's like a small to medium size con.
Yeah,
but it's completely it's like 700 people, maybe.
Yeah, it's had its ups and downs. They've had some pretty high profile authors there in the past who have brought more people in.
Yes, last year Neil Gaiman stealth attended.
Ooh.
Yes.
Were you there the year that William Gibson was supposed to be there?
I don't believe I
and
was.
And that was one of the few years it got held, I believe, in Framingham.
Right, the first couple of years, I forget where it was held, but right, that was Framingham for a little while, and then it's been in Burlington for quite a while now.
Yeah.
But this year there were a lot of great authors. There was no huge name like on the level of say Gibson or Gaiman. But there are a lot of great authors. The great thing about ReaderCon is not just that it focuses on the literature, but it's really easy to meet people. You know, you'll bump into Liz Hand in the halls, and she will give you a hug. And you will bump into, Kelly Link and Maureen McHugh and Harold Waldrop. And, And it's great. I mean, if you want to meet authors and talk to authors, there's really no better place to go. And that's part of the reason that I really love it. But also, it can get a little wonky, especially mm-hmm. in the panels. And I like that, too. So there's a lot of talk about reading. There's a lot of talk about the writing process as well. One minor complaint I heard from some people this year, people who attended with me and others, was there was more of a focus on writers this year than readers in terms of the panels and such.
Really?
A lot more discussion of technique and tropes and somewhat less discussion of the literature itself and topics around the reading literature and enjoying the literature. But like I said, for me, someone who's a writer and a critic and an academic, it's kind of the best of all worlds for me. It was great. I led two panels, one on the idea of estrangement, which we talked into pieces, and then I also led a panel on framing the fantastic, talking about paratext and thematic devices that frame fantastic stories. Both of which had John Clute on the panel. So,
yes. Well, let me ask you.
Go ahead.
Having emphasis on techniques and things like that. I mean, I think that would be of interest to readers as well as writers.
Yeah.
If you delve deeply into a text, you want to know a bit about the technique.
Sure. And the estrangement panel, I thought that was quite evident, actually. We talked a lot about not just the use of the technique, but how readers experienced estrangement and how the idea had positive aspects to it and also problematic aspects to it. And especially in the Q&A, there was discussion of specific stories and specific novels and how estrangement popped up in them. So but often in the past, there's more discussion of particular books, particular subgenres, particular authors, and it was not quite as in evidence this year as in the past.
Not just that, but there's always been things about the experience of reading,
right?
Which was something that really had a lot of historical WorldCon panels in its DNA, where they would talk about it. I remember there was the whole stripe of the real year of a book, which was, you know, talking about the book in the context of which the time it was written and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, sure. You bring that up, and actually someone gave a great talk on willing suspension of disbelief this past weekend.
Really?
That was me.
There you go.
So
excellent. You're really bumming me out because I went 19 years in a row. I missed the very first one, but I went to all the others. And last year and this summer, because I moved to Virginia, these are the 2 years that I missed. And yes, I miss it. I miss going down to the used book superstore down the street.
I'm actually working on my blog post of all the stuff I bought. and the blowing of my book budget. But, you know, I found some great stuff. I found an early dystopian novel called Strange Manuscript Found in a Copper Cylinder. I found a first edition of that.
Ooh.
I have to retake the pictures because my lighting was really terrible. But that's going to be on my blog probably later this week or early next week will be my book haul. And I found an early edition of a Yeats collection, which you wouldn't expect to find at ReaderCon, but there were actually three or four great older booksellers like selling older books this year. If I'd had the money, I could have bought a first of Algernon Blackwood's The Human Cord. I could have bought a pile of early utopian and dystopian novels from the 1850s, 60s, 70s, 80s. I mean, it seemed this year more than in the past few years at least, there were a lot more people selling older materials. I got a couple of SF Horizons, the UK periodical from 1964, which have Kingsley Amis and C.S. Lewis fighting about science fiction definitions. and an interview with William Burroughs, actually.
Wow.
Talking about how science fiction influenced him. And this is in 64. So I can't wait to read those, because I'll actually probably write a column on them for SF Signal, because I am very curious to see what the debates were like 50 years ago, essentially.
Yeah, really. That's the flame war of the pre-internet, so.
Yes.
Excellent.
When someone calls Ray Bradbury a sex titillator, you've got to find out.
Yeah, I'm really bumming I wasn't able to go. I have yet to actually live tweet a convention. I think WorldCon's probably going to be my first one. So,
and I did that as well. I live tweeted two or three panels.
Oh yes, I was following along.
And actually, I find that really helpful for me to think about what's being said in the panel and sort of codify what people are saying. As much as communicating to other people what's going on in the panel. And it's a great exercise, I think. And I actually pay more attention to the panel, quite honestly, when I'm doing that.
Wow.
Yeah, definitely.
That's interesting. That's very interesting, because I tend to take a ton of notes every time I listen to a panel.
I usually do, too. And actually, I'll often be tweeting with one hand and typing or writing notes with the other. So. But again, like I said, that's the great thing about ReaderCon, is that there's just this great focus on the word itself, on the words, how they get put together. And if you're looking for, 3.5 days of that, it's really the place to be.
No, it is. The one of the years that it was in Framingham, I did a column about ReaderCon a couple of years ago, and I retold this story about the hotel was being shared with a very large contingent of people from the Bronx and Long Island who had come up to the area for a wedding, and this woman came up to me in the bar and talked incessantly about the fact that why is this hotel full of all these antisocial people? I said, "What do you mean?" She goes, "There's all these people sitting in the lobby and in the hallway reading books." And I was like, "Well, reading is by its nature a antisocial activity, so that's why we all come here on this weekend to discuss it." Excellent. Yes, I'm very, very bummed that I missed it. So, good. I'm glad you had fun. I'm glad everything went well up there.
I had fun. I learned a lot, and I met some new people, and I renewed some old acquaintances. And yeah, it's like I said, it's my favorite con, and it's really one of the best things I think I do all year.
And I'm really going to make an effort for next year to get up there. So
that'd be cool.
So, one of the things that we had been tweeting about, gentlemen, over the past few weeks was what I am loosely categorizing as "get off my science fiction lawn." Mm-hmm. There were a few things that appeared on the internet that just sort of caused more seasoned fans. I don't want to say those who take their fandom seriously, but to roll their eyes a little bit. And the one that John and I had started talking about on Twitter, which sort of became the catalyst for this whole thing, was that Blaster had done a list titled "Are These 14 Science Fiction Books Really Not Worth Reading?" And this had been culled from a rather lengthy discussion that had been in a comment section on Reddit concerning books that people did not like. The books that were distilled down to the list on Blaster included things like 3001 by Arthur C. Clarke, Saga of the Seven Sons, Sphere by Michael Crichton,
Dahlgren.
Dahlgren was on there. There was a
Stranger in Strangeland.
Strangeland. Well, before we list everything there, right. This was, and occasionally you'd have something like Forever Free by Joe Haldeman, the sequel to Forever War, and what was triggering in my mind was I think everybody had the same thoughts while they were reading this list, which is like when Dahlgren came up, we all said, "Okay, I can sort of understand that. It's not for everybody." But then when Battlefield Earth comes up, you're like, well, this isn't for anybody. Okay.
Right. That was the problem. The problem was, it's like, let's go to Reddit and find 14 random books that people said something crappy about, and let's make a list.
Well, it seemed like it started out
all over the place. The criteria just all over the place for what makes it not good.
It seemed like it started out with the intention of looking at classic books and why we can't get through these. But then, of course, like with any internet discussion, it rapidly calved off into, you know, a moaning session about random things tossed in randomly.
Right.
I mean, yes, 3001 A Space Odyssey is a weak book, but is it the same? Does that mean the entire series by Clark is no good? Is 2001 a better book? Is right. all of Clark bad?
Well, Clark's on there twice. For Rendezvous with Rama or Rama 2?
No. Rama 2, which was mostly Gentry Lee, not Arthur C. Clarke.
Okay.
So, you know.
Well, that sort of triggered my issue because picking sequels to, let's face it, classic books that are pretty universally considered, you know, part of the canon, whether you enjoy them or not, is kind of a fish in a barrel type of situation, because there's very few sequels along those lines where they're actually trying to recapture what made the first book in the series great. Often it's an exercise in exploring possibilities that were left untapped in the first book. But then there were other ones. There was like some relatively contemporary books like Wind Up Girl and the Dune prequels by Anderson and Herbert and stuff like that, which seemed to be almost, you know, I think it's a given with a contemporary book that hasn't quite, you know, earned its stripes yet historically, that, yeah, it's not for everybody. There are going to be, you know, opinions on either side. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are some canon books that some people genuinely do not like for very legitimate reasons, whether it be style or tone or message or whatever.
Well, what is the canon?
Precisely. That's a very loose definition, you know, and it's a hard thing to pin down, and we could probably talk for several hours on that.
I was just about to say, did either of you read Foz Meadows' column at Blackgate about how she as a reader constructed a completely different background from the canon to become a science fiction fan than other people often counsel is the canon you must read?
I mean, I personally thought
it was pretty well done, actually.
Is that the latest issue?
It's on their blog. It was earlier in the week, I think. She put that up there. But the interesting thing about it to me was not that she was necessarily she wasn't refuting the canon, so she was saying there's no one way for people to become fans of science fiction. There's so much stuff out there that you can come from a number of different directions and still be a quote unquote, you know, real fan.
I would agree.
Exactly.
She was sort of right going against this whole you know, hey, you kids, you didn't read enough Heinlein when you were young, so you're not a real fan kind of a rhetoric. So it's interesting to think about that in relation to this list, where there are some of those classics, and there were just some terrible books. Like, really, like, one of the books is called The Worst Piece of SF Crap Ever. And it's on the same list as, you know, Red Mars and Dahlgren.
Yes. a quick answer that I would give if I had to just shoot something off the top of my head would be, I would consider, in a very broad sense of the word, I would consider just about everything that's ever been nominated for a Hugo and probably a Nebula for that matter, as at least in some way canon. Does that mean they're required reads? No, by no means. But I think those are books that have certainly, you know, stood the test of time. Does it make them necessarily better than something that's come out in the last 10 years? No, by no means. There's been a lot of books that have, you know, most of the stuff that I've read by Ian MacDonald, you know, far outstrips a lot of books that I've read, you know, from my childhood through early adulthood, etc. So it was one of those, you know, I think the thing that bothered me the most about seeing that list up there was that this was considered science fiction news. This was considered worth making a post out of. I mean, yeah, maybe it was a slow news day, but still.
What exactly is Blaster?
Is it
an actual news organization, or is it just something that scrapes stuff and it's a million miles wide and a millimeter deep in depth?
Yep.
So, you know, they found what appeared to be a controversy on the internet. Oh my God, a controversy on the internet. How original. And made a story out of it. Yeah. Whether it's a year from now, we actually are still discussing it. I doubt it.
Yeah. I would agree.
Yeah. Forever War is a much better book than Forever. Was it Forever Peace or Forever Free?
For Free was what?
Well, there was Forever both. Free. He wrote Forever Peace and Forever Free.
Well, whichever one they mentioned in the article,
right,
or in the thread. I mean, I wouldn't hand anybody starting out in science fiction Dahlgren, but
unless you want to scare the hell out of them.
But on the other hand, when I first read it, I read it when it first came out, and it made a big impression on me, maybe because it was, I was still relatively unformed at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But in reading it now, I appreciate it more, having read, for example, Borges, where he mentions, it wasn't Dahlgren, but it was a word very similar in a book, in a story that was kind of a similar form to the book, where, you know, the beginning of the story loops back to the end of the story and so on. I'm like, oh, wait a minute, you know, hey, look at that. So I don't think there's a canon, but I think if you read classics and then read newer stuff, you can kind of see where people evolved their stories that they're writing today, and that makes you appreciate both better.
Oh, I would agree with you there. I mean, even if you make your definition of science fiction and fantasy particularly narrow and conservative, still the odds are that in your lifetime, hell, the three of us are combined lifetimes, we're only going to read perhaps 5% of everything that was published. So.
Oh, yeah.
Also, recently, Fred, you went on a little bit of a Twitter rant about a review you had listened to, if I remember correctly.
Well, there's The Verge, V-E-R-G-E, another one of these news sites. And they've kind of last year started doing a book club, which is supposed to be monthly, but kind of is averaging every other month or every third month. And they've covered things like Ubik by Philip K. Dick and Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson. And this month they did Neuromancer by William Gibson. And other than the first episode where they had Lev Grossman on talking about Philip K. Dick, I just find the panelists they just come across being very unprepared. I mean, at one point during this Neuromancer review, the one panelist said, he's trying to describe a part of the book, and he said, well, maybe I should have made some notes. It's like, you know, I mean, I kept saying, and they would describe things about William Gibson, and I would say, are we reading the same author? Like, you know, oh, all he writes about now is brands and rich people. Like, well, yeah, in pattern recognition, there's rich people, but there's a lot of people living on the fringes, like an ex-spy living in a trailer sitting in front of a pile of smoked cigarettes. I mean, that guy's not exactly the same economic class as Biggin, one of the other characters in the book. It just seemed to be these episodes, they seem to be throwing them together without much prep and without much thought, and you end up screaming at your iPod. Or tweeting on Twitter about screaming on your iPod.
Screaming at your iPod is the first sign of curmudgeonliness.
Well, or driving on Route 80 too much, one or the other.
Yeah, that's true.
If you're going to cover a book, you know, I think you need to do a modicum of preparation. research about the time that the author's writing in, the other works of the author, and actually maybe reading the book and taking notes while you read it so you can sound semi-intelligent.
Mm. I'd also add to that that if you're discussing a book that was seminal to not only a subgenre and held up as a figurehead of a subgenre, but also gave a shot in the arm to science fiction in general, a degree of context is called for as well. So.
Oh, yeah.
So, very good. Well, enough complaining. We love the young people, and we love their quirky little reading habits. We really do, honestly.
Just stay off our lawn.
Yeah. Let's talk about a couple things that we've actually liked. Last time we talked, I had recommended a couple comics that I had read, and we had discussed each reading something in the graphic format and talking about what we thought about it. And John, I believe you read Hypernaturals, which is what I recommended last time.
Yes.
And what did you think of it?
Well, the complaining's not over yet, Jeff.
Okay.
I had mixed feelings about it. There are aspects I liked and aspects that I didn't like. I liked the art overall. I thought the art was fairly well done. And it seemed to sync with the mood they wanted to create in the story. So I thought that was great.
Okay, speak up a tiny bit, John.
Sure. So I liked the art quite a lot. The art was quite good. And the writing was okay, not great. I love the stuff Dan Abnett did for the Marvel Universe, for their space titles. This seemed a little more dissolute to me. Now, it's focused. There's a story he wants to tell, and I can see that. But it just feels weakly constructed.
Hmm.
There's not a lot. I'm at the point now where when I read comics, I want a little bit of meat there. I'm not looking for, Dostoevsky, but I do need a little bit of maturity in what's going on. Unless I'm reading something, flat out goofy like Calvin and Hobbes. And even then, Calvin and Hobbes can have some fascinating themes. But what got me, actually, was the world. The biggest problem I had was with the world. I thought it was a really poorly conceived singularity because the whole premise behind the book is that in essence the singularity has been achieved and humans are living in sort of a golden age where there's instant transportation and there's all these great technological benefits and people live all over the galaxy. And it was a very disconnected singularity. It was very much to the side, kind of in the background, like, hey, the transporters don't work. Darn that singularity. And part of the idea of the singularity is that it actually affects human beings. They don't keep acting the way that human beings sort of normally act. There's a shift in the species and the way individuals interact, and not just technological advancement. So that just felt... It just didn't hang together very well for me. It was very easy to pick apart. And it's hard to not, of course, compare it to Legion of Superheroes.
Right.
Far Future Supergroup. And having been a Legion fan when I was young, it was hard not to compare it. I tried to not make explicit comparisons, but the way that the team hung together and was sort of reconstructed, I didn't feel it felt kind of forced. There's an intriguing crisis, but the way that it gets addressed seems really, really anemic to me.
All right.
So it was kind of hard to get into the story. There are parts that I liked. I liked some of the characters. I liked the Brainiac character. I was very amused by. And the two rookies I thought were pretty well done, but the other two main characters really felt not stereotyped. They definitely weren't stereotypical, but but just not that interesting.
I'd actually go so far as to say stereotypical. I would.
I think the clone guy was definitely stereotypical.
Yes, he was.
And I thought they tried to stretch a little bit with the other character, the super fast woman who's who's the PR director basically for the team. But it just, I didn't care about those characters. They weren't that interesting. They were more like cogs in the story.
Yeah, they were.
Whereas I thought the rookie characters actually brought most of the life in the story comes from them trying to deal with being new superheroes. That was far more interesting to me than a lot of the other stuff that was going on.
I hadn't really thought of it that way before. Yeah, okay, all of that. I'll go so far as to agree with you with all of that. I think for me, the reason that I enjoyed it as much as I did was, as I mentioned, it was nice to see somebody try to do a future super team book and at least try to pay even at least lip service to some 21st century science fiction tropes, as opposed to, you know, you mentioned Dan Abnett's comic stuff at Marvel, which I did love, which was very good and stuff like that, but it did seem to hang on the whole, hi, there are a bunch of dueling galactic empires that hate each other for obtuse reasons, etc.
Right.
And for me, it was just kind of nice to see someone try to repaint that canvas and try something new with it.
It's intriguing to consider, what if there's a future where the human race, the human species, is basically at peace. I think it's a very intriguing concept to explore.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't believe that it was possible given what seemed to be almost no change in human culture and society. Like, each of the sections of the comic start with that sort of news update stuff, and I felt like I was reading CNN Today.
Yeah.
Like, how is that possibly different than what happens today? It's not. It's like, you know, it's like today, with hyper teleportation system, and that's pretty much it.
You know, it's funny you should mention that, because Abnett and Lanning also wrote, several years ago, DC tried something called DC 1 Million, which was where the present was visited by the Justice League from whatever month and year the 1 millionth issue of DC Comics would have come out.
Is that before or after the new 52?
This is well long before the new
52. I was making a joke. In other words, the renumbering.
So he did a short story that was basically the character Resurrection Man working with this giant data and news engine, directing Superman, who was flying around the solar system, basically correcting everything that's going wrong at transluminal speeds. And it's all about a discussion that the two of them are having. And it's funny that you bring up the whole idea of the world being at peace, because that story basically was about the solar system is at peace solely because Superman is flying around at superluminal speeds, correcting everything that's going wrong. And he used that future CNN news flash to tell the kind of fluff stories of items that were going on around the solar system. And also to show how the media of the future, the AI media of the future, was actually covering Superman's, you know, superluminal adventures as he goes around fixing everything. So now I want to go back and read that. Excellent. Fred, what did you read?
Well, I went with something else that we had also mentioned and discussed, and I went with Harlan Ellison's Dream Corridor, Volume 1 of 2. Which I kind of think, from my lack of knowledge, is probably written around the same time as Sandman, if I'm correct, or not.
They would have definitely overlapped.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, Dream Corridor had a fairly irregular release schedule at times. There were several months or every 2 months where it would come out quite regularly, but I'm certain there was some. Plus, it came back a few times.
Right.
I don't have it off the top of my head, but I'm certain they must have intersected.
I mean, I think it might have been a great idea in discussion, but not as good in execution. The format is Harlan Ellison's, I guess his house, has this dream corridor where he has his stories play out. And each story is rendered by a different artist, and you have a little bridging material where Harlan introduces the artist or the story, and then they go through the story. But in seeing these stories that I've read many times, or many of these I've read in short story form, they just didn't seem to have the same punch as in graphic form.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite sure why, whether because they feel so much briefer, or my imagination was not as engaged, or what. It just didn't seem to work as well. Plus, a lot of the stories that they used were not as well known, or I mean, I would have, for example, loved to have seen maybe Repent Harlequin, or if they could have done Demon with the Glass Hand, or When Jeffy Was Five, or something like that. But you know, there's a couple of crime stories and a couple of stories with some fantastic elements, whatever. And I just kept saying, oh, you know, I think Sandman was much better.
I think Harlequin is in Volume 2, or it might have been in a standalone, or I could just be completely misremembering it, but I'm fairly certain that I saw Harlequin get done at one point.
Yeah, it probably was. I mean, the other thing I read, which I thought, weirdly enough, it looked like a comic, but it wasn't, was The Book on the Edge of Forever by Christopher Peace. Priest, put out by Fantagraphics. So it kind of looks like a comic, but it's not. And that, of course, is the story of The Last Dangerous Visions, the book that is forever on the edge of being published, but not quite getting there. So that was not quite a graphic novel, but I bought it thinking that, oh, is this a graphic novel examination?
Yeah, the thing about Dream Quarter for me was always I found it interesting. And for the most part, I agree with everything you said there, but I found it interesting because it was possibly the only time that I can think of, with perhaps the exception of Empire by Howard Chaykin and Delaney. Where a science fiction author pretty much had almost absolute control over the comic book version of how the comic book renditions of the stories are being played out, you know, where he pretty much had a say in the artists and he edited the books and stuff like that, and it was a relief to see that after a lot of really bad adaptations, but but yeah, there was a couple standalone volumes that came out as trades later on. I think I have most of them here. Now I want to go back and reread them. I did
We're not helping you move forward there, Jeff.
No, you're not. Speaking of that, I went back and reread the comic book adaptation of Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere, which was written by Mike Carey and drawn by Glenn Fabry, a writer who, and an artist who I love immensely. Mike Carey wrote the Sandman spinoff Lucifer, which is probably still my favorite comic. It was very interesting reading it, because I had probably about 6 months ago watched the BBC miniseries, and I had also listened to the BBC audio dramatization. And it's very interesting seeing the differences in pacing for the different mediums, and also where the various parts, the various chapters, come to a close before leading on to the next one. Part of it is because of the nature of the medium, but also, a lot of it is the rhythm and the pacing of the story, where you decide to put your cliffhanger, where you decide to end the part that you're currently on. I found that very interesting. This is probably the first story that I've been able to experience in that many mediums since Hitchhiker's Guide.
I was just going to say, was Hitchhiker's ever done as a graphic novel?
Yes, it was.
Oh, goodness.
I want to say it was DC that did it. I would. It was a far better adaptation than the movie. I'll give you that much. But then again, anything would be. Yeah, it was pretty good. I think part of the problem that they had with it was they weren't certain how to give it a visual language. And as a result, I kind of borrowed from a lot of different things. It's been a long time since I read it. I wanna say it was three issues, but it might have just been two. I'm not certain. But anyways, yeah, the Neverwhere comic is great because when you get to a really good eyeball kick, Glenn Fabry makes sure you get an eyeball kick out of it. And he also plays a lot with perspective. One of the best things about Fabry's art is the fact that he's able to he's actually able to render scale. If you're walking down a close-lit, you know, a very small corridor with a torch, it feels claustrophobic. When you come out into the great big cavernous palace, it you know, your breath gets taken away. When the supernatural stuff kicks in, when the beast appears, you know, when the angel makes himself known, etc., it's done differently from the novel, but it's done in such a way that the same effect is rendered. And Mike Carey gets a lot of credit for that in my book. He's able to, he's really able to understand graphic language and how to convey a point simply through the art, and then he lets the artist go with it. There are a couple spots that are a little bit dead to me, and a couple of the characters I thought were slightly under-imagined for the graphic version, but it really was. I got through the whole thing in about 45 minutes, and I was like, well, I forgot how good this actually was. Very good. The last thing, just like last time, I wanted to see if you gentlemen had read any stories recently that turned you on.
Yes, I have.
Oh, go ahead, Fred.
Well, I read, fortunately I didn't write down which issue. I read an issue of Interzone, which featured a story by Man About Twitter, Lavi Tidhar, one of his Central Station stories, and I enjoyed that a lot because it harkened back to C.L. Moore's story about the Shamblou, which yep. was... you know, it was nice to see that nod backwards, speaking of a canon or whatever. Then I read the August Asimovs, and nothing really grabbed me there. On a much better end were a couple of books I read. I revisited two authors, three books, Terry Pratchett, Monstrous Regiment, and Lords and Ladies. Monstrous Regiment is about a... regiment made up both of multiple races, and it turns out that every single recruit turns out to be a woman pretending to be a man. And yeah, you know, and then there's, I mean, one of the best parts, at least for me, was a vampire who had taken the black ribbon, which on the Discworld means that you forsake the drinking of blood, but in order to do that, you have to substitute something else, and this vampire substituted coffee, which worked great until somebody stole all his coffee beans. So I've had days like that. Lords and Ladies dealt with a period where the edges between the different worlds gets a little thin, and in this case the elves try to break through again, and the elves aren't the nice creatures that Tolkien, you know, or many other fantasy writers have depicted. The elves are very, very nasty, nasty people. The other author was, and the other book was Glenn Cook, Dread Brass Shadows, which is part of his Garrett P.I. series, which is, if you look at the covers of these books, you see a guy in a trench coat against a fantasy city background, but, you know, it's noir. But he's really, you know, not dressed in a trench coat. But Glenn Cook just captures that noir writing style perfectly. You know, the descriptions of the women, the fights, the way the main character always gets beat up, stumbles around until the solution to the mystery presents itself. I mean, this one in particular has some passages which are just letter note perfect for the Maltese Falcon. Mm. Especially the movie. I mean, there's one character which is Sidney Greenstreet to a T. So if you know, again, going back to the canon, if you know the canon of mysteries, you're like, oh yeah, look at that, isn't it funny? And, you know, Glenn Cook always makes me, both of these guys, Terry Pratchett and Glenn Cook, always make me laugh. work has been hell lately, so I've needed a lot of laughs.
Amen there. Yeah, I am woefully behind on Glenn Cook. I have several here on Mount To Be Read that I have not gotten to.
Well, what I like about this series is, yes, they do kind of link to each other. You know, they do mention occasionally something from a previous book, but you really don't need to read them in any particular order. He gives you the background of the political situation and the war that's been going on forever, or the locale, or the major characters, you know, enough in each book so you really don't need the previous ones. It helps, but you can't pick them up anywhere.
Wow. Wow, yeah, I like that. I'm going to have to look into that.
Yep.
For my pick, I have to throw myself on the mercy of the court and voluntarily hand in some of my fanboy points, because over the past week, I discovered the Arcanate stories by Matthew Hughes, and I'm actually kind of shocked that I had never read these before or were even aware of their existence. I had read Matthew Hughes' entries in anthologies. I really liked his piece in Songs of Distant Earth, Songs of a Dying Earth.
Right.
Yeah, Jack Vance tribute anthology, which actually mentions in the preface that he had written this series about the Arcanate taking place in the epoch immediately preceding the Dying Earth. I had picked up Black Brilliant at McKay Books down in Manassas probably about 5 months ago. And it was next on the pile that I have next to the couch, and I started reading it, and within 100 pages I was like, I must have other stuff by this guy here, and I went looking and I did not, and I hung my head in shame. So I immediately bought for Kindle the Gist Hunters and Other Stories, and the Gist Hunter blew me away. I was amazed at how good and how charming and how exciting of a story that was. And I will probably be spending the next couple of weeks looking for other books in the entry that I don't, other books in the series that I don't currently have. But I felt very, very small having realized that such a large contribution to that particular motif in the genre had gone unnoticed by me.
And I think I picked them up on Kindle recently too. A couple of them, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, they were all going for a pretty good price.
Right, right.
They were, and if I remember correctly, when I had been down at McKay Books, there had been several paperbacks down there, and I had grabbed this one because it has a Tom Kidd cover, and mm-hmm. I'm kind of a completist when it comes to Tom Kidd paintings, because especially when they have large vehicles on them. One nice little stack of books with covers that I like, and his always tend to go to the top. And I also have to say that the cover to this book nails it perfectly too. It nails the vessel that most of the story takes place on. But I grabbed it. I went out the door on Sunday. I'm currently without a working washing machine, so I went to the laundromat around the corner and sat there, put everything in, cracked it open, and about 100 pages into it, I was like, this is far better than I was expecting when I walked in here. So not that I was expecting it to be bad, but I just didn't really go into it with any expectations. I literally thought it was just a straight science fiction novel. You know, I really wasn't going in there with any expectation of tone. But I am now, in the last week, I am now a Matthew Hughes fan.
Did you read... Is it Simmons did a Dying Earth novel recently too?
Yeah, that's also that. Yeah, the Guiding Nose of
Right.
That's yep. All. That's also in that anthology. That's the last story in Songs of, and it just came out as a standalone.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, it's a great story.
Yep.
I don't think there's any bad stories in that collection, quite frankly.
So. Oh, it's an excellent yeah. collection.
All right.
Well, Mr. Excellent. Stevens, what have you read?
Yeah, John, what do you got?
The thing that I thought I would bring up is I've actually, one of the far too many books I bought at ReaderCon was was Daniel Jose Older's Salsa Nocturna. And which is a story collection. And I'm two stories away from finishing it, but there's plenty of good stuff in it to discuss. I mean, it is a mix of noir, horror, and fantasy. It's the best way to put it. It's often written in a pulpy style. The characters are often very much like characters you see in noir, like down on their luck types. Like one of the characters is a half-dead guy who works for a bunch of creepy dead people.
oh, you mean Fred?
Thanks.
Has to do their dirty work for them. Another one is a cab driver who gets a very strange fare and ends up helping destroy a demon. It's a pretty good collection. I'm not a big noir fan, but I really liked most of the stories. And the first one, Tenderfoot, was pretty good. And it also served as a very good introduction to what Older is going to do throughout the collection. Sort of a strong signal that he's going to do stuff that's kind of weird, kind of noirish. He's very interested in gender dynamics and class dynamics and various and all types of social dynamics, and they play a sizable part in what he writes.
What year did this come out?
Just came out. It's only been out, I think, a few months.
Okay.
It's a pretty new collection. It's from Cross Genres Publications. So it's quite good. I recommend the collection. And like I said, the two stories that I've liked most so far are the first one, Tenderfoot. There's also one towards the end, which has a bad word in the title, just so you know. It's Love is a Fucking River. And that's the sort of the demon slayer cab driver one. And that's really good because the character who's narrating is not really a deep person, but Older structures the narrative and what he tells you in ways that give you a lot more insight into the character and the story than that person might have, like, than I say an average cab driver might have been able to tell you. One of the things I really like about this is how he does that trick of having narrators who may not be the best storytellers in the world, but because of how he structures the story and tells it, you learn more about the characters and about the situation. It made me think of, I was on one of the panels at ReaderCon, we were talking about readers, and during the point of view panel, talking about how first person is often dependent on the narrator being a really good storyteller, often better than your average person would be. You know, almost all first-person narratives are by someone who's a really good storyteller. And somebody uses the example of, like, you know, Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn. Like, you know, an illiterate teenage boy is probably not going to be that good of a storyteller. And yet it's a great book. And in Older's collection, there's a fair amount of first-person. And the narrators aren't great storytellers, but what they choose to tell us and how he structures what they tell us sort of enhance the story. And I like the approach because you're not sitting there going, oh, yeah, you're, of course, you know, your average cab driver is such a gifted storyteller. but he's not, and yet it works really well. So I'm pretty impressed. There are a couple of stories that don't work quite as well for me as others, but most of them are pretty darn good. And I'm still two stories from the end. But I certainly recommend it, and I am very pleasantly surprised overall.
To any cab drivers out there listening to this podcast, send your hate mail to. Very good. Once again, gentlemen, a very good discussion. I have lots and lots of notes, things I need to follow up on.
Well, we will, of course, include links to titles and sites and Reddit articles and whatever.
We make this a fully immersive experience, and when you're dealing with the three of us, that could be frightening. So
right.
All right, gentlemen, why don't we wrap this up? Fred, what's your Twitter handle? Where do you blog?
Oh, just Fred Kish, FredKiesche. And I am inactively not blogging at the Lensman's Children, trying to find a weekend where I'm not committed to do other things where I can redo the site. So stay tuned there.
I look forward to that. Mr. Stevens.
Yes.
Wow. People just leaving me hanging tonight.
Yes. I'm still here.
What's your Twitter handle? Where do you blog?
Twitter.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry, totally made it out there for a second. Yes, my Twitter handle is Erudite Ogre, all one word. And I also blog at SF Signal. I have a regular column there, and you can also go to my sometimes updated blog. It's mysterious when I'll do it. jhstevens.wordpress.com.
Very good. And I am Jeff Patterson. I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at baddaysstudio.com. I am Jeff Patterson 11 on Twitter, and my new book, Don't Tweet Where You Eat, is culled from my Twitter stream, which is reason enough not to get it, but I really wish.
And has a stunningly glowing review at Amazon.
Yes, it does. by a tall, dark gentleman. So, gentlemen, I thank you both, and I thank the listeners for tuning in, and we'll try to do this again next month. Have a good evening. Say goodbye, gentlemen.
Good night.
Good night.
After 15 years in space, Cord Cahill is returning home. His parents passed long ago, his younger brother is off defending border worlds from the expanding Republic, and his sister, whom he left behind, is dead. How she died, he doesn't know, but she left him a video message predicting her own death, and he wants to know what would drive her to do such a thing. His homeworld has changed, but so has Cord, who now wears the gray cloak and hat of a sentinel. They mark him for what he is, a gun for hire. But this isn't about Cord, it's about family, about Katie. How she lived, and ultimately, how she died. Cahill's Homecoming, the new novella from Patrick Hester. Available for Kindle at Amazon.com and as an EPUB from BarnesandNoble.com. Cahill's Homecoming. It's about family. Thank you for listening to the SF Signal podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. To comment about this or any of our podcast episodes, please call our voicemail line at 720-277-9082. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Wah, wah. And scene.